and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an uptick in civil strife in Portland, sparked by a 1,000-car convoy of rural Trump supporters organized by a far-right group, Patriot Prayer, who drove into Portland on Saturday night, firing paintball and BB gun pellets at counter-protesters. Jason Wilson, a reporter for The Guardian based in Portland, Oregon, joins us to discuss this provocation, which the mayor of Portland has condemned, blaming Trump for the hate and division in America, saying, quote, "You've tried to divide us more than any other figure in modern history, and now you want me to stop the violence that you helped create?" We'll examine the Patriot Prayer movement, which many times over the past 3 years has held pro-Trump demonstrations in Portland, which have led to violent clashes with anti-fascist activists. This time with a member of Patriot Prayer, who may or may not be Jay Bishop, was shot dead, prompting Trump to tweet out, "Rest in peace, Jay." No such tribute was paid by Trump to the two Black Lives Matter protesters recently shot dead by a Trump supporter in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Then we'll examine the actions of the unqualified Trump loyalists running the office of the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe and Kash Patel, who 10 weeks before the election have decided to stop giving Congress in-person intelligence briefings on foreign interference in our upcoming election. Katrina Mulligan, who served as an attorney advisor to the National Security Division of the Department of Justice and on the National Security Council staff and in several roles within the office of the Director of National Intelligence, joins us to discuss how the American people will now have no idea who is meddling in our democracy to help elect Trump and hurt Biden. Then finally, we will speak with Jeffrey Kabasevitz, who is the Director of Political Studies at the Niskanen Center and author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party, From Eisenhower to the Tea Party. He joins us to discuss what kind of bounce Trump got out of the Republican convention and whether Biden's remarks today will alert the American people to how Trump is deliberately inflaming civil unrest to scare suburban whites concerned about public safety into voting for him. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate, which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now, Jason Wilson, a reporter for The Guardian based in Portland, Oregon. His latest article at The Guardian is Portland suffers serious street violence as the far-right return prepared to fight. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Wilson.
Always lovely to chat, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the far-right Patriot Prayer Movement organized this caravan of pickup trucks, etc., mostly coming from rural Oregon into Portland with the far-right supporters. Flags, they were carrying firearms, but they were also using pellet guns, BB guns, and paintball guns, and batons, and all kinds of stuff. It's not that they just attacked the anti-fascist protesters and the Black Lives Matter protesters. They also seemed to attack the press. So what did you witness?
Here's what's happened in the city over the past couple of weekends. I think in the article, what I point out is that, you know, after a long period, you know, 85 nights, I think it was, of unbroken protests from, I suppose, broadly left-wing demonstrators, Black Lives Matter supporters, after 85 nights of that, the city really returned on the Saturday before last to a dynamic that has, you know, it's been subject to throughout the era of the Trump administration, and that is contentious, polarized demonstrations, you know, which frequently culminate in violence. So that's what happened downtown on the Saturday before last. That, and then, you know, we went through another part of the cycle that the city's seen for the last 3 years, really, which is that when that kind of violence erupts, it becomes a topic of discussion, in conservative media. It is picked up upon by national politicians, including the president, often enough. And then that leads to a bigger and more violent confrontation, you know, in the following week. And now, since everything that happened on the weekend, including the shooting death of a man who, it seems, was a supporter of the Back the Blue protest, as it was called. Well, actually, it was called this one was called the Trump Convoy, but it's associated with a Back the Blue movement. A gentleman who was supportive of that appears to have been shot dead by someone the Oregonian is reporting this morning, who's being investigated for homicide, who was themselves this. The shooter was, it seems, or the alleged shooter was, a regular attendee at Black Lives Matter protests. And so what you're seeing now is that groups like the Proud Boys are promising, you know, to come back towards the end of September to have a big rally with, you know, lots of out-of-town people like they've had over the previous 3 years. We've seen that cycle kind of repeat itself. What was different, I suppose, about the violence we've seen over the last couple of weeks is, I think, those things that you mentioned, you know, a preparedness not to just use fists and batons and mace or pepper spray, but now we're seeing paintball guns or pellet guns being used effectively as, I suppose, less lethal anti-personnel weapons, you know, that kind of thing, which has mostly been coming from the right-wing side, although the Saturday before last, there were a few pellet guns on the other side as well. That sort of thing is new, and it's kind of chilling because, you know, you begin to wonder what the next step is after that. But in any case, I mean, those things can take out an eye. Wherever they hit you, they're really quite painful. They can cause quite serious injury. And as far as I know, discharging him in that way in a public place is illegal. And that's something I'm kind of pursuing now with both the Portland Police Bureau and the Multnomah County District Attorney. You know, I'm wondering, I suppose, if they're going to be pursuing any illegality that happened in that situation.
So in attacking the press, though, one of the Proud Boys broke the hand of somebody that I recently interviewed who reports for Bellingcat and has been really one of the best reporters on the beat, has he not? He's been covering all these demonstrations for months now. What happened there? And is there any are the police and the district attorney going to do anything about that?
So that's another thing that I have been asking about. I mentioned that in my story. Yeah, Robert Evans, who is a very, you know, as you said, you've spoken to him yourself, and he's a very good colleague, and he's someone who has been on the ground now for months. I mean, he's taken nights off here and there, but essentially he's been there the whole time. It's a pretty impressive feat of journalistic endurance. Unfortunately, a couple of Saturdays ago, one of the attendees on the right-wing side chose to lash out at him repeatedly with an ASP baton, and bones in Robert's hand were broken as a result. So, that person was... he picked the wrong person because, you know, as soon as Robert was injured, the entire Bellingcat community, which your listeners may be aware of, is a kind of open source intelligence type outlet. So they're very, very good at identifying people from pictures or, you know, locating pictures on a map, things like that. They're very good at, you know, going on the internet and finding out unexpected things about images or footage or people. And they really very quickly identified this guy as someone called Travis Taylor, who is a Proud Boy who lives in the Portland metro area, who has been, you know, seen at previous protests. From all of the video and from what Robert told me, there was no kind of provocation from Robert himself. This was just something that this guy, you know, decided to do. So I'm very curious about whether or not, you know, the authorities will be following up on that. But again, it's just one of those matters that I'm, you know, trying but failing to get an answer to. And there's a lot about at the moment.
Well, the fact that in this demonstration on Saturday night, this 1,000 car or truck or pickup truck convoy of out-of-town rural Trump supporters, which was organized by the Patriot Prayer Movement, they were shooting at the press as well, which, of course, given that Trump has said the press are the enemy of the people and these are pro-Trump supporters, that shouldn't be surprising. But you mentioned that the member of the Patriot Prayer, Jay Bishop, who was shot dead, that the police are looking at a Black Lives Matter demonstrator. That really does change the dynamic, because only a few days ago in Kenosha, Wisconsin, two Black Lives Matter protesters were shot dead by a 17-year-old white kid, pro-police white kid carrying an AR-15 assault rifle. And Trump, of course, did not say a word about that, but he tweeted out a tribute to Jay Bishop saying, "Rest in peace, Jay." So do you think that changes the dynamic, and it would seem to be feeding right into Trump's hands, wouldn't it?
So one thing to say is that identification of Jay Bishop, I would be cautious about that. I'm not sure that it's actually going to turn out to be him. That was the social media stuff yesterday, and Trump retweeted someone claiming that, but he's been identified by Joey Gibson and people who are close to him as actually being someone called Aaron Danielson, who went by Jay. So that hasn't been confirmed by the authorities yet. So that's one thing to bear in mind, that it's still a very, very murky situation. But yeah, I mean, look, you know, the last week it feels to me like a little bit of a turning point. I think that shooting in Kenosha, which the entirety of conservative media and the whole conservative movement have sought to play down or to characterize as self-defense, you know, and to really insist that this guy did nothing wrong at all, despite the fact that he was going to a contentious protest, you know, armed, and that he, you know, engaged with people who he had come to oppose, who, while he was also armed, you know, they've insisted that there's nothing wrong with that. Then in between you had the Republican National Convention, where the president spoke and where he framed his re-election campaign really as, you know, him running against Antifa, which is the great bogeyman of conservatives at the moment. And then immediately afterwards, you know, you had someone who, you had an alleged shooter, certainly someone being investigated by PPB, who was a regular attendee at Black Lives Matter protests and was supportive of those protests. Yeah, it feels like something of a turning point, you know, and it feels like perhaps that the combination of those events, well, you know, it's certainly open to President Trump to make political hay from these events and to really work some more on trying to reframe this election as one that's not about his competence, his response to coronavirus, or his initial response to the Black Lives Matter movement protests, which happened all around the country earlier in the summer. And he's really got the opportunity now to reframe it as basically him running against left-wing protesters in the streets and to really tie them to the Democrats. And that would make for an exceptionally divisive election campaign. I think that's coming either way. But if he were to win on that basis, you know, it opens up a kind of a frightening prospect of, I don't know, an extremely sectarian political environment post-election, put it that way.
Well, just in closing, Jason Wilson, what do you think about the mayor of Portland's response saying, "Trump, you've tried to divide us more than any other figure in modern history, and now you want me to stop the violence that you helped create"?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for all of the very well-founded criticisms that have been made of the city of Portland and the mayor's response to not just the last couple of weekends, but the last 4 years, really, of contentious street protests in the city, for all that those criticisms may be well-founded, it's difficult to argue with him on that point. I mean, I think that cycle I described at the beginning is really reliant on both conservative media, social media personalities, you know, associated with the far right, and the president himself to really intervene in Portland in a way that turns up the temperature, that polarizes the protests even further, that attracts people from beyond Portland or beyond the state, you know, to come in with the intention of at least, you know, a kind of confrontation with those who they see as their political enemies. And you know, to be honest, a lot of them come in with the intention of committing violent acts. And we've seen that happen over and over again. So, yeah, I think that in every time that this has happened in Portland, the president has been the opposite of helpful. And it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that the president sees chaos, division, confrontation, and even violence as helpful to him, certainly in the context of his election campaign. He appears to think that the worst things get in Portland or Kenosha or anywhere where there are contentious protests, the better it is for him.
Well, Jason Wilson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thanks. Always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I will speak with Jason Wilson, who's a reporter for The Guardian based in Portland, Oregon. And his latest article is Portland Suffers Serious Street Violence as Far-Right Return Prepared to Fight. We're going to take a restation break and back looking into the actions of the unqualified Trump loyalist running the office of the Director of National Intelligence, who 10 weeks before the elections have decided to stop giving Congress in-person intelligence briefings on foreign interference in our upcoming election.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can..."
Don't wanna live in a prison cell. Don't wanna live in a smoking room. Independence just don't come to you. In the brief of a diplomat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Katrina Mulligan, the Managing Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. She previously served as an attorney advisor and director for preparedness and response in the National Security Division at the United States Department of Justice, where she also represented the department on a wide range of National Security Council policy committees. Prior to joining the DOJ, she served on the National Security Council staff and also served in several roles within the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, including as Associate Director for Strategic Communications Initiatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Katrina Mulligan.
Very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of the phone call, I guess, that the heads of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees got on Friday from the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, informing them that they would no longer be getting in-person briefings about election security and would have to rely on written updates? And making this change, you know, 10 weeks before the election, John Ratcliffe said that the move is an attempt to ensure clarity and consistency. But a lot of people aren't buying that. Do you buy it?
Look, anytime the intelligence community, particularly when led by a relatively new and fairly partisan director, decides that it's going to withhold information from Congress, I think the American public should be concerned. That's especially so when what we're talking about is something so foundational to our democracy. Foreign efforts to interfere, which we know they did in 2016, and the intelligence community has already indicated, is ongoing. And so it's really difficult to square the severity of what is being what is happening in our democratic process with this decision to just, you know, hey, they can just only see what we've written and published, and that's enough. I disagree, and I really think there are kind of two problems with what's going on. One is that DNI Ratcliffe, who is brand new to his job, and is widely understood to be the least qualified DNI ever to be confirmed, is making these decisions. And from what I hear from my colleagues in the intelligence community, this decision was made rather hastily and without the kind of careful deliberation that you would expect of a matter this serious. Now, he may not understand the full scope of his job, but pursuant to the 1991 Intelligence Authorization Act, the intelligence community is required to keep congressional intelligence committees fully and currently informed of intelligence activities of the United States. And that's a broad requirement that certainly, almost certainly includes intelligence related to foreign interference in our democracy. So when Ratcliffe says that he's going to provide written intelligence products, what I think we should all understand is that is a poor substitute for an in-person briefing with experts where you have the opportunity to question and probe the facts and understand the confidence levels of the assessments. There's just no substitute for a written briefing. Second issue that I see is that the net effect of what the Trump administration is doing to politicize intelligence and break from all the norms regarding intelligence hearings is that they are essentially undermining public confidence in the intelligence agencies. And in a critical election year, as foreign actors are seeking to interfere in our democracy, the Trump administration is refusing to hold the annual threat assessment hearing, depriving the public of information about the threats facing the nation. And now the DNI is refusing to provide threat information briefings to Congress. And so while I can sort of understand why the Trump administration would want to restrict information about Russian efforts to interfere on his behalf, Congress really shouldn't allow it.
Well, Senator Angus King, who's an independent, he says it's an outrage. It smacks of a cover-up of information about foreign interference in our elections. If there is foreign interference in our elections, we should know about it before the election. The Intelligence Committee is not a history organization. It's a current events organization. I think he put it pretty well, didn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, it simply cannot be that for the final 10 weeks of this election, the only people with a full and current picture of what Russia is doing to interfere in our election are President Trump and his allies. I mean, that's not the way that elections should be run. Congress and the public and his opponent have a right to know. And trying to restrict and limit the distribution of this type of information on matter this important, it doesn't make sense, and it's inconsistent on its face with what they are saying that they're trying to do. And I really don't think Congress should accept it.
And again, I'm speaking with Katrina Mulligan, who's the Managing Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. She previously served as an attorney advisor and director for preparedness and response at the National Security Division at the United States Department of Justice, where she represented the department on a wide range of National Security Council policy committees. And prior to joining the DOJ, she served on the National Security Council staff and also served in several roles within the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, including as Associate Director for Strategic Communications initiatives. So you mentioned earlier that obviously lawmakers on the Senate and House Intelligence Committee, and when you have an in-person briefing, you can question the briefer and ask for more details. And I mean, we've already gotten this recent report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which they offered up rather reluctantly, and it suggested that the Russians were trying to discredit Joe Biden. It didn't actually say specifically that they were in favor of Donald Trump. It just said that they were trying to undermine Joe Biden, particularly, and they mentioned this seedy character in Ukraine, who Giuliani and company have been working with. And then they went on to say that the Chinese they started out saying the Chinese and the Iranians are the top two players in terms of meddling, which is clearly not true. Russia's done it before. They've had their rehearsal. They know what they're doing. They're much more skilled. China, as far as we know, is not meddling in the elections. But what they said about China was that they actually prefer Biden over Trump and that they want consistency and stability in the relationship. I don't buy that. I mean, when you look at what's happened to the United States, the world's leading hegemon is now a basket case. Its economy's in free fall. It's locked down. It's, for all of Trump's talk about a wall, we're all walled in. We can't even leave the country. The Canadians next door don't want us in. Our economy, as I mentioned, is falling through the roof. We've got 6 million infections, which public health officials say could be 10 times worse, really. So surely Trump is the gift that keeps on giving, not just to Putin, but to Xi Jinping. If he's our rival and an aspiring hegemon, surely he's sitting back and watching us flounder. And by the way, a lot of countries around the world, our friends and allies, are taking pity on us.
I mean, look, I think it is correct to say that there are certainly those in China who would be thrilled to see Trump's reelection and to see us continue in a downward spiral. Anything that harms the U.S. To some in the Chinese government would be advantageous from their side. But, you know, I think that comparing China and the way that they influence and seek to interfere with what Russia has done is a mistake, because there really is a tangible difference between, you know, the subtle ways that the Chinese try to interfere in the U.S. political process, which is really around the margins, and the very direct and hostile way that the Russians did interfere and are seeking to interfere again. And I think that the Trump administration is really trying to make an apples to oranges comparison here, because they think it's politically advantageous to do so. If they can say that, well, look, China favors Biden, and so Russia favors Trump, what's the big deal? It's a gaslighting effort. When in reality, there is a big deal going on, and it's not going on with what China's doing. What the big deal right now, as it pertains to our democracy and to our elections, is that Russia is actively seeking to interfere and to sow discord in the United States, and to get people to take actions that they wouldn't otherwise take. And that is a huge problem. It's a problem that this president has refused to acknowledge or do anything serious about. And, you know, I really think that the focus on other countries is misplaced.
Well, Senator Chuck Schumer said that Ratcliffe, the head of the DNI, Ratcliffe has made clear he is in the job to protect Trump from democracy, not democracy from Trump. So we shouldn't have any illusions, surely, about who he is. We've seen him as a kind of pro-Trump attack dog when he was a congressman. I don't know how he was ever confirmed. He has no background. He lied about his efforts as a U.S. attorney in terms of counterterrorism, which was a fiction. His deputy, Kash Patel, is a complete Trumpster and ideologue, a protege of Devin Nunes. Surely we shouldn't have any illusions. These people are put in there by Trump to do Trump's bidding. Isn't it that simple?
I mean, I'm honestly I'm dismayed by the willingness of this administration to put people into positions that are this important to our national security, who have absolutely no experience and who are motivated by what benefits Trump, not what benefits the American people. And I mean, I think you said it exactly right. I think Ratcliffe and Kash Patel, to the same degree, are sent there to protect Trump from factual information, and not to inform Trump or the rest of his administration about threats. And, you know, that's really backwards. That's not what the job is supposed to be. And, you know, I feel for my former colleagues in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, who are having to navigate, you know, first it was Rick Grenell, who also had no business being in that role. And now, you know, Ratcliffe, who really, you know, just lacks the gravitas of the kinds of people that came before him.
Well, it's pretty clear that you've seen how Trump treated the earlier heads of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, particularly the Republican senator, former Republican senator from Indiana, who was a fairly, you know, moderate, centrist kind of Republican, not one of the new breed that we have now. He was treated very shabbily. Then his replacement, Admiral McGuire, was treated very shabbily. In fact, Sue Gordon was supposed to take over. She was given the back of Trump's hand. isn't it clear what he's saying? The signals must be clear to everybody in the intelligence community. I don't want to hear the facts. I just want to hear good news and never mention Russia.
I mean, that certainly seems to be the case. And you know, one of the sort of sad tales of the story of the Trump administration is that, you know, no good men and women have survived first contact. I mean, he has a way of tainting the reputations of everybody who engages with him, no matter how noble their objectives are when they join him. And we've seen that time and time again, both inside the intelligence community and outside of it. You know, when a new administration takes over, assuming that that's what happens in November, you know, they're going to have a lot of work to do to restore faith and trust and integrity in these institutions. These institutions have been deeply hollowed out from the inside. A lot of career civil servants, myself included, have left the ranks of the civil service rather than continue to serve in ways that are inconsistent with our values. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult to turn that aircraft carrier around and, you know, restore a sense of mission and purpose that is very rooted in what's best for the American people and not what's best for the executive branch and the person at the top of it, because it has been a culture shift that's taken place over the last 4 years to the detriment of, you know, a lot of the public servants that I know and worked with.
Well, just in closing, the New York Times is revealing an extraordinary piece of new information regarding when Comey was fired. There was kind of a panic at the top of the DOJ, and acting head of the DOJ, the deputy head of the DOJ, Rod Rosenstein, at the time, decided to put together a counterintelligence investigation into Trump because they had no way to explain why he just fired Comey. But then he very quickly buried the report or stopped the activity, didn't tell the FBI, and then went ahead and told Mueller that he wasn't even to go near any kind of counterintelligence investigation of Trump, that his mandate was only to look for crimes. So it strikes me as a kind of similar to what Barr did in outmaneuvering to mischaracterize the Mueller report. But this sort of sabotage, if you will, was done much, much earlier. So what do you think was going on with Rod Rosenstein? Was he really, along with Barr, trying to bury this story? And we still haven't seen this counterintelligence report, not that it necessarily went very far, but clearly there have been previous counterintelligence files on Donald Trump, none of which have ever been made public. So I suspect that at the end of the day, that might be the smoking gun.
Yeah, I mean, for those of us who followed the Mueller investigation carefully, you know, I think most of us always believed that the counterintelligence investigation was where the action was going to be. And it's important, I think, for your listeners to understand the difference. When we use these terms like the criminal investigation versus the counterintelligence investigation, it all kind of sounds the same, but it's actually quite different in some very important ways. A criminal investigation is really looking for a crime that has been committed. It is backward looking. It is always focused at something that has already occurred. What is really critically important about a counterintelligence investigation is that it is broader in that it looks at the potential for a crime that hasn't yet been committed, for activity that poses a threat from a foreign government or foreign government actors. And it's not centered on a specific moment in time when something criminal may or may not have occurred. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of things that I think all of us have learned in the past 4 years that may be legal and that we think shouldn't be. But in the case of a counterintelligence investigation, they would be looking at how to identify and mitigate threats posed by a foreign government really broadly, which would have meant examining Trump's financials, looking at the totality of the circumstances to try to get a sense of whether the president or any of his associates may have been acting at the behest of or at risk of being utilized by a foreign actor for purposes that are counter to U.S. interests. And the the thing, by choosing to shut that part of the investigation down, what Rosenstein did was really disturbing in two ways. One is that it dramatically limited the focus of what Mueller was allowed to look into. And second, he did so in secret. And that's the thing that's really odd, because when you look at the public letter that he put forward outlining what Mueller was going to be looking into, it read as though it was also a counterintelligence investigation. And certainly there was a lot of reporting around that time. Everybody believed that that there was both the criminal investigation and the counterterrorism. But at some point, Rosenstein shut the counterintelligence side down, but he did so in secret and didn't inform the FBI of it. That to me is very unusual, and that's something that I think a lot of reporters are going to be digging into more in the next in the coming days and weeks, and they should, because I have a lot of questions about why we wouldn't have looked into that, and it frankly means that the story is not finished.
Well, Katrina Mulligan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be here.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Katrina Mulligan, who's the Managing Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. She previously serves as an attorney advisor and director for preparedness and response in the National Security Division of the United States Department of Justice, where she also represented the department in a wide range of National Security Council policy committees. And she also served before then on the National Security Council staff and in several roles within the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, including as Associate Director for Strategic Communications Initiatives. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether Biden's remarks today will alert the American people to how Trump is deliberately inflaming civil unrest to scare suburban whites concerned about public safety into voting for him.
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck.
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jeffrey Cabaservice, who's a director of political studies at the Miskenen Center in Washington, D.C., as well as the author of several books, including Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party, From Eisenhower to the Tea Party. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, the Republican Convention depicted an alternative reality. Will Americans buy it? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Cabaservice.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do we know about the ratings, the so-called bounce that normally happens from a convention? Did the Republicans, and Trump in particular, get a bounce?
So it appears from early indications that Republican viewership was down, not just from what the television viewership had been for the Republican convention in 2016, but also somewhat lower than what the Democrats had. But it does appear that Trump is getting somewhat of a bounce. However, that could also partly be because Joe Biden had been so far ahead in the polls that we're now seeing more of a kind of natural closing of that gap.
So you also had a recent article titled "Trump Has Failed the QAnon Test," and I bring it up because Trump tweeted out yesterday a bizarre QAnon anti-science theory about COVID-19 and the pandemic, which Twitter took down. Do you find it extraordinary that the president has literally allied himself with that bizarre movement that believes that the Democrats are a bunch of child sex traffickers and that they commune with demons and worship Satan?
You know, I find the QAnon movement extremely bizarre. I find it extremely strange to think that an American president is giving it any credence. But I don't actually find it that strange that Donald Trump is giving this movement credence, because the whole idea of QAnon is that Donald Trump is the hero of our times. He's working behind the scenes to defeat these nefarious, cannibalistic, child-murdering enemies in the deep state. And even what looks like failure is actually going eventually to be revealed as success. So it's all part of the strange dynamic of the Trump presidency.
But as you've written about in your book, Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party, the Republican Party in the past has actually purged some of these bizarre elements, like the Robert Welch's John Birch Society. And nowadays, you've got people like Liz Cheney and others who speak up against QAnon. But now that they've elected or she hasn't been elected yet, but she's a shoo-in to be elected down in Georgia, it does seem that the Republican leadership in the House is suddenly silent after calling her a complete disgrace.
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to be elected from Georgia's 14th district in the election. That's almost certain. You know, I argued in my New York Times piece that the Republican Party understood that it was in its own best interests to marginalize what they called the kooks. And the John Birch Society certainly was a pretty kooky group that believed that Republican President Dwight Eisenhower was a conscious, dedicated communist agent, that the civil rights movement was a communist plot, and that intellectuals at the University of Chicago were concocting a nefarious plan to take away Americans' right to vote and hold property. In some ways, the QAnon movement is even worse, and it's also a kind of gathering of conspiracy theories. So it not only believes it's sort of central conspiracy that Donald Trump is fighting the evil deep state, it also draws in anti-vaxxers and people who believe other kinds of somewhat off-the-wall beliefs. But the Republican Party simply is not doing a good job in marginalizing QAnon. There's much more that they could have done to intervene in that primary race, for example, to make it clear that they did not support Marjorie Taylor Greene or her QAnon beliefs, or for that matter, her racism and anti-Semitism. And they really did not do enough there. Obviously, Donald Trump has embraced the QAnon movement, I think simply in the belief that anyone who supports him is someone whom he likes. But another critical difference between the 1960s and today was that actually William F. Buckley Jr., who was the leading conservative of that era, also turned against the John Birch Society, said that it made the movement look ridiculous and pathological, and firmly separated himself from QAnon, whereas a lot of conservatives and Republicans nowadays are just kind of shrugging their shoulders and going along with it, or if anything, enjoying the spectacle of the movement triggering the libs. So yeah, I think we're in a very different kind of era nowadays.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Cabot-Service, who's Director of Political Studies at the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C., as well as the author of several books, including Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party from Eisenhower to the Tea Party. And he has an op-ed in The Guardian, The Republican Convention Depicted an Alternative Reality. Will Americans Buy It? So I guess the question here is, in both in terms of the convention and what we saw at the convention and who we saw at the convention, and what we're talking about in terms of QAnon and the history of the Republican Party resisting kooks and cranks or trying to purge them, the opposite seems to be happening. So the question then arises, Jeffrey, what is the rank and file now of this party? Now, do we have any real polling? It seems like the party of William F. Buckley is now the party of Jerry Springer.
Well, that's a pretty good comparison. But that's partly to do with the changed base of the party. You have it exactly right. And at the time William F. Buckley was writing in the 1960s, the Republican Party was mostly the party of the educated, college-educated upper-middle class. Whereas now the Republican Party is very much the party of the non-college-educated white working class. In fact, to the point where more than 6 out of every 10 Republican voters is a non-college educated member of that class. And so this has, you know, entailed a different kind of emphasis within the party and also within the conservative movement. And Donald Trump very much has played to that as well. Now, what I found fascinating about the Republican National Convention was that it actually wasn't completely geared toward the base. A lot of it was actually geared toward the college-educated middle class in the suburbs, and particularly women. That's why it was so important for part of the convention to portray Donald Trump rather implausibly as a feminist who values women and their contributions. And to play the Republican Party as completely open to the contributions of people from all races. You had, you know, almost a record number of African-American speakers at the conference. And I think this is not because the party realistically expects that it's going to get large numbers of African-American votes or votes from other minorities who've turned against the party, but it might just make the party look acceptable to a lot of college-educated suburban women who turned away from the party in 2018 because they really didn't like the things Donald Trump was saying and tweeting about women and minorities and race relations. So it was a bit of a schizophrenic convention for that reason.
Well, I was thinking in terms of the couple from St. Louis who pointed an assault rifle and a pistol at the Black Lives Matter protesters, in the sense that isn't there also a lot of people that voted for Trump are in the kind of 401k world, small business type, people like the couple who pointed their guns? It's not entirely disaffected white working class people who used to vote Democrat.
You know, the St. Louis couple, the McCloskeys, live in this sort of grandiose Italianate mansion in St. Louis. And, you know, there are certainly some people in that situation. You know, what I think the Republican Party was hoping to do by including them in its roster of speakers was play on fears of rising crime, which is connected to a kind of potential white backlash against the Black Lives Matter movement, but also speaks to Democratic vulnerabilities on the issue of crime and rioting. Although I think Joe Biden has actually taken exactly the right stance on these questions, you will find people in the progressive end of the Democratic Party who will not condemn rioting. And who see this as a distraction, and who also are very reluctant to condemn violence for fear that this would put them in the position of criticizing the Black Lives Matter movement. So in that sense, I think the Republican Party did accurately and with some canniness play upon potential fears among this swing group of Republican voters, particularly in the suburbs and particularly women.
Well, of course, Joe Biden did address that today in his speech in Pittsburgh, where he started out saying, you know me, you know my heart, you know my story, my family. Ask yourself, do I look like a radical socialist with a soft spot for rioters? Really? And then he went on to say, The simple truth is that Donald Trump failed to protect America, so now he's trying to scare America. I think it's Biden could have been a lot stronger. I think it's much more cynical than that, isn't it? Isn't Trump really stirring up racial strife in order to benefit from it?
Absolutely. You know, and there's obviously a lot of contradictions in this position. You know, these are things that are happening on Donald Trump's watch. What reason is there to believe that they will improve if Donald Trump is reelected to a second term? There also was a contradiction in the Republican National Convention where Joe Biden was simultaneously attacked for being weak on crime and also attacked for being the author of the 1994 crime bill, which incarcerated too many African-Americans in the telling of some speakers. So I think this whole idea to make Joe Biden into this horrible villain is not likely to succeed. But I do think the Republican Party, like I said, is doing its best with this crime issue because it does speak to some real anxieties on the part of some movable voters.
Well, how do you think, though, the Portland story is going to play out? And presumably, we could have these kind of incidents all the way through to November. We could have this country roiling with civil strife. It's pretty clear that from what the mayor of Portland says, and of course Trump attacked him quite vehemently and in a sort of nasty, childish way, but in a way that was extremely unpresidential, but very much Trump. Do you think that Trump is doubling down here? Because having that 1,000-car convoy was provocative and was so, and then, of course, Trump tweeted out support for the person who was shot, etc. So is this what we have in store for us? It seems to me that Trump has discovered the best plank he has, because there was no platform, by the way, at the Republican convention. There's no platform, there's no policy. But it does seem that appealing to the center and to a certain anxiety about public safety he's decided that might be his ticket to, for four more years.
I think you're right. And, you know, the thing that people don't necessarily understand about Portland is it's a kind of sea of liberalism surrounded by rural conservatism. And most members of the Portland police force, in fact, come from those outlying areas and are wholly unsympathetic, even to the peaceful demonstrations, let alone to the violent demonstrations that tend to come once night falls. And so you have the situation where it's actually very easy to start a provocation by having this kind of convoy of trucks of Trump supporters spraying the Black Lives Matter protesters with tear gas, shooting them with paintballs, and seeing matters escalate from there. And really what you also are seeing coming out of Kenosha, Wisconsin, is armed groups of protesters and counter-protesters clashing in the streets in a way that, in a small level so far, still conjures up images of the Weimar Republic. And even to the extent that some of this is due to provocation from the right, I think Trump and his advisors believe that they will benefit from this. Because in times when there is chaos in the streets, in times when local governments seemingly can't guarantee the safety of their citizens, citizens are more likely to turn toward an authoritarian force to actually restore order. And I think that is the cynical gamble of Donald Trump in this election.
So are you talking about a kind of ongoing Reichstag fire?
that's not a bad analogy. It remains to be seen whether Donald Trump will actually persuade a critical mass of Americans that he needs greater authority to deal with this threat. But it could be that he persuades just enough of these swing voters in the swing states that his brand of force will be more effective in quelling these riots than Biden's, on the one hand, on the other hand, approach, where he's understanding that there are legitimate racial grievances with regard to policing, and on the other hand, trying to say that demonstrations should be nonviolent and trying to discourage this kind of armed clash. To be determined which case will be more appealing to the American voters.
Well, of course, Biden again today in Pittsburgh accused Trump of, quote, fanning the flames rather than fighting the flames. So we're still in the fire analogy, right?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's been a continuous
adequate, in other words,
Donald Trump's presidency. It's consistent.
It's consistent, but it's not tough. When you were saying earlier, you know, that there used to be a reasonable intellectual basis to the Republican Party and to its policies. Something happened to the country. I mean, in many ways, I think that Sarah Palin was a turning point, even though the person who chose her, John McCain, is more of a traditional Republican. It's as though what happened when she came along, people suddenly thought, oh, she's just like we are, you know, and a whole constituency came out of the woodwork, if you will. Is there anything to support that theory?
You know, I think that most observers and political scientists feel that the change in American politics from the 1960s versus today is that both parties used to be much more geographically, ideologically, and socioeconomically diverse. People tend to forget that a greater percentage of Republicans in Congress voted for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act than Democrats. But what eventually happened after those acts were passed was that Southern voters passed into the ranks of the Republican Party. The Republican Party's base became largely white, whereas you had actually had a significant number of minority supporters in earlier times. And the Republican Party started to speak to white identity at the same time that Democrats emphasized minority group identity. So you do have the situation now where you have racially divided parties, and that's dangerous and volatile. And if you want to put any kind of silver lining on the Republican convention, it at least had this sort of imaginary vision of an America in which both parties would compete for African-American votes. But in reality, Trump is able to get away with stirring up racial grievance because the parties are divided along these racial lines. And it's just a dangerous time for our country.
But it seems to me the biggest fantasy that was spun at the Republican convention was that the COVID 19 pandemic is over. It's like he did such a great job, it's just over, and we don't have to think about it anymore. Is that going to fly? I mean, we're getting close to 6 million infections. And by the way, most public health officials say that it could be 10 times higher than that. And the what are we around, certainly at 180,000 or more, we should probably be at 200,000 deaths relatively soon, don't you think?
I think that's quite likely. And yet, I don't think it's going to change the minds of people whose minds are already made up. I think it's obvious that Donald Trump has presided over the worst cumulative job loss of any country, of any president in our recent history. People will notice that. But, you know, Trump has actually succeeded in making the wearing of masks into a partisan issue, which is also part of what has driven the spread of COVID-19 to the point that we've handled this pandemic worse than any other developed country. And yet, to his supporters, you know, that he's up against, again, fake news and the self-interested maneuvering of the deep state. And it's very difficult to persuade people of this mindset of any other way of looking at the situation.
Well, just in closing then, Jeffrey, what does it come down to? Does it come down to whether or not there are enough people capable of critical thinking, educated, of people who actually read newspapers, as opposed to people who, you know, engage in conspiracy theories and have share crazy stuff on Facebook? And I just don't want whether there's any polling out there. But at the end of the day, if Trump is reelected, I mean, when I talk to people abroad, they can't believe what's happening. And frankly, we are literally, for all of Trump's talk about building a wall, we are walled in this country. We can't even travel. The Canadians next door don't even want us. So from abroad, people are starting to pity us. But if this guy gets reelected, I think most people around the world will think, my God, America's lost its mind.
I think they will think that, and they might well have reason to think that. And there was that famous Fintan O'Toole editorial in the Irish Times, I believe, which did say that America, for the first time in its history, is pitied around the globe. I don't know what will happen, to be honest. I think there are considerable reasons to believe that the election will be closer than polling has it. And Donald Trump has a very dedicated base of support. And as America seems to be spinning off into chaos in at least certain of its urban cities, the Republicans are going to be able to make that law and order case to a certain number of persuadable voters that they will do a better job, despite past performance, of restoring some semblance of order. But, you know, all the time this is happening, America's position in the world is sinking and the country is becoming simply less prosperous, less of a force, less able to maintain the kind of order that America had done so much to maintain since the end of World War II. So in that sense, I think Donald Trump is one of the leading forces in undermining the country and its position in the world. And my hope is that there is enough elements of the traditional Republican Party that they can see that they can demand something new and better and ultimately more popular than what Trumpism is offering, because Trump's presidency may well be seen in hindsight as the last gasp of an all-white party in an America that's rapidly diversifying, and that's simply not sustainable for the long run in a democratic polity.
Well, Jeffrey Campos-Service, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Campos-Service, who's Director of Political Studies at the Niskanen Center in Washington, D.C., as well as the author of several books, including Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party, From Eisenhower to the Tea Party. And he has an op-ed at The Guardian, The Republican Convention Depicted an Alternative Reality. Will Americans buy it? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. The headline written down in
fire.